Court is ready to hear argument in 050147, City of San Antonio versus Hartman.
May it please the Court, Dan Foxa, present arguments for the defendant. Mr. Ryan Clinton will present arguments for Henry Secura, State of Texas. Mr. Foxa will open with the first 10 minutes. Mr. Foxa will also present the defendant.
May it please the Court. Obviously, the state of Texas and I are here for all purposes and all questions, although from the standpoint of presentment, and because Curie State of Texas will present on the 021 general waiver provision of the Tort Claims Act and probably on 056 discretionary powers exception, the question that the City of San Antonio would like to present and address the Court with is whether an emergency existed to provide the city's government immunity under 101.0552. And in doing so, we look at the statute initially, the legislative intent as seen from the words in that statute. In looking at 0552, it is not limited by its terms to, for instance, EMS or police or fire. Obviously, the legislature knows how to do that. In fact, they actually did police and fire in subsection 3 of that very same section. 0552 could have also been limited, were intended to be limited, by saying it applies to only 021-1 cases, that is, cases involving motor-driven vehicles or equipment. That would have been an easy way to limit it if that was legislative intent. We also try to give to a statute meaning to every provision within that statute. So had this section 0552 stopped at emergency call and not gone on, then something closer to perhaps the interpretation that respondents would like to give might be appropriate. The statute does go on, though, and talks not only about responding to emergency calls, but also reacting to an emergency situation. And as the Court knows from this record, there are probably no reported cases that come close to matching the emergency situation that the City of San Antonio employees were reacting or responding to in this flood in 1998. The Court of Appeals in Texarkana in the Durham versus Bowie County case, that emergency situation is found by that court as a matter of law. That emergency situation is at least in the same neighborhood. I think the court in that case describes and actually recites the number of county roads and highways that were affected that this county was trying to respond to. In fact, the court, in a footnote in that case, says it's easy to classify this as an emergency situation given the entire situation. And the court, and again, respondents would have us look very specifically just to this event, just at the time that they're sort of, if we, from our perspective, sort of micromanaging the policy decisions of the city, but they're looking at just this narrow moment in time when either a barricade was there, wasn't there, was placed there, wasn't.
Why isn't that significant? Surely they wouldn't care about other areas where the barricades were put up properly. They're concerned about where their client was killed.
Right. No, I understand that, Your Honor. And, of course, the state of cause of action, they're not going to describe this whole context. But for our purposes now, I think it is important in determining whether or not an emergency situation should apply here to look at the entire situation. And the reason why I bring that up is because in these automobile cases where it has often been applied, EMS cases, things of that nature, by definition, we're responding to an emergency call. By definition, these are typically unitary moments in time. The emergency is an isolated event. Now, that also obviously also is the plaintiff's cause of action. Here, of course, the plaintiff's cause of action is, again, this unitary time. But in Durham versus Bowie County, they looked at, and I think properly, the whole emergency situation to see the applicability of the act. So I'm not critical of them for obviously picking the event. I mean, obviously, this is an event of a great tragedy involving this family. But for purposes of this emergency exception, whether it's applicable, I think it is appropriate not to just isolate what they're doing at that moment, but to contextualize it as the court in Bowie County versus Durham.
Assuming it's an emergency, does that give the city or any other government entity a carte blanche to perform in any manner, to put up barricades or other warning devices to the public?
I think the statute itself sets out the limitation on what the city's able to do or not able to do in an emergency situation. I think as long as they're acting in accordance with, if there are laws and ordinances applicable to this emergency situation, if they're acting in accordance with those laws and ordinances, they're immunized. There's the governmental entity is immunized. If there isn't applicable laws or ordinances relative or relevant to this emergency situation, but they're acting less than reckless, less than what we might call a gross negligence standard, then they and thus the governmental entity is fully immunized.
Well, how does a trial judge get there? How does a trial court get there? Those seem to be all issues that could create fact issues.
Well, for instance, in this case, I don't think there's even a pleading of gross negligence. Certainly the evidence is clear that whatever the conduct, and I think, frankly, there's evidence that there at least was one barricade, however it got there. But in this case, there is a pretty good full description. And I know this is initially on plea to the jurisdiction, but this is almost like a summary judgment record, in some cases better than a lot of summary judgment records. There's a lot of evidence in this case, in this particular record, that tells this story. And there's nothing in that story from anybody's perspective that gives any indication other than the city making judgment calls, doing the best they could under this situation. Could they be breaching some ordinary negligence standard in the midst of this emergency situation for over these 48 hours? They possibly could be, but there's nothing to indicate that they were acting with some sort of wanton disregard, recklessness, anything that approaches a gross negligence standard. The City of Arlington versus Whitaker case obviously is the case that first applied premises defect cases to this statute for reasons similar to what I've described. Bowie versus Durham County, Durham County case also has. There is a 2003 case from El Paso Court that was not, it's not a published case. I think it's a City of El Paso versus Segura that's not been briefed. 2003 case where El Paso now also in that also applies it to a premises defect case. And what's interesting about that case, because it raises some of the complications if we want to sort of carve out, depending upon what's going on, whether or not to apply this emergency exception. In the City of El Paso versus Segura, what happens is a drunk driver apparently runs into some barricades, and there's also a light indicator, a big sort of, you know, those arrow things that's kicked into when they run into the barricades, kicked into the middle of the road. Police respond to that emergency. They realize they cannot get this device off the highway without a record. So they call in for help, take care of the other aspects of this case, of the car wreck case. Another drunk driver runs into this obstruction in the highway. The El Paso court says, and it's interesting, it was done in a memorandum of opinion, it's sort of rich in facts and it's interesting, and I think possibly not first impression, something that begs some detail, and it is somewhat detailed. But the El Paso court was met initially with, should we apply the emergency exception? There they held that judicial immunity, there they held that the plaintiff had pled that it was an emergency and they were sort of stuck with the emergency situation. What's interesting, though, about that case from a problem-solving standpoint that we face here, what's interesting about that case was they were unclear whether this thing out in the highway was some sort of motor-driven equipment, whether it was a use of property under the statute, or whether it was some sort of premises defect. Now, using the emergency exclusion and saying that it applies regardless of whether it's a motor-driven equipment, et cetera, they didn't have to answer that question. But obviously, if we want to carve it more narrowly, despite the statutes not carving it for us, if we want to carve it more narrowly, the El Paso court in that situation would be left with quite an interesting sort of debate amongst themselves on what to call this thing that's now been thrown out in the middle of the road.
In the average tort case, we don't allow the emergency instruction if it's an emergency created by the defendant. Would that be true of this, too, if the city created the emergency? You couldn't create an emergency and then get out of it saying we weren't consciously indifferent.
Right. For instance, in my El Paso case, obviously the city's not creating this emergency, right. But if the city creates the emergency situation or...
It is right. I mean, the exception in the Tort Claims Act has almost always been invoked in chase cases. If we invoke it in something beyond that, where do we stop?
Well, Judge, I think that the Bowie County urged a definition that sort of said an urgent need for assistance or relief, and I think it does have to be somewhat definitional of what an emergency situation is. But I don't see where anything involving this case is some sort of slippery slope by any means. No.
Will it always be a matter of law determination, or can you envision a scenario where that issue is going to go to a jury? Do we really want that kind of situation?
Judge, a number of these cases, before we ever thought about applying them to premises, would go to the jury. I think the Fourth Court cites its own case and some other cases where it was sort of a fact question. It may be another question, not briefed in this case, whether we should treat it like whether something's a premises defect or a special defect, whether something's use or non-use, and those are often factually intertwined. There's a lot of facts involved in those, but the courts decided that that's a question of law. And although that's not been briefed in these cases, there's a lot to be said for going that route. And I will give the podium to the state.
It pleases the court. At its core, this case is about decisions. It's about the decisions, the split-second judgment calls of the city dispatchers to prioritize the innumerable crises during the historic flood. Those decisions embody the type of government discretion for which immunity is expressly retained under the Act's exemptions. It's also about the decisions of Donna Obar to drive during the flash flood, to drive to around or circumvent at least one warning barricade, and to attempt to cross a flooded highway. Those decisions preclude an actionable premises defect claim under Section 101-2021, the Act's general waiver provision. For both reasons, the court should render judgment for the city. Following the Tort Claims Act structure, the court should first look at what it has termed the threshold issue in every Tort Claims Act case, that is, whether or not there has been a general waiver of sovereign immunity under Section 101.021. When the answer to that question is no, as it is in this case, the court's inquiry should end. Here, plaintiff's suit fails to invoke the general waiver provision 101.021 for two reasons. First, the warning barricade across the middle of the highway that confronted Obar before she reached the flooded waters gave her all that she was entitled to receive by law, a warning. Indeed, the evidence is uncontroverted that at least one warning barricade straddled the middle of the highway west of the intersection, or west of the floodwaters. That warning precludes a premises defect claim. Second, the risks and dangers of driving during the historic 1998 flood were open, obvious, and perceivable under the circumstances. Indeed, in this case, Obar admitted in page 3 of the clerk's record that she altered her driving knowledge to avoid other areas of flooding and to avoid other high water crossings. So she knew that this was something that could be expected under the circumstances. And under this court's jurisprudence, both in Lower Neches Valley Authority versus Murphy and Walmart versus Miller, a licensee is not entitled to warnings of conditions that are perceivable or the existence of which can be inferred from the facts within the licensee's knowledge.
So there was no need to have any barricade up?
Under the circumstances of a flash flood where the claimant is fully aware that there is flash flooding, under 021, that premises defect claim would not fall within the waiver of immunity. But even if plaintiffs had an actionable claim within the general waiver provision, Section 101.021, the city's immunity would nonetheless be retained by the Act's exemptions for discretionary conduct. I would point the court to three of the Act's specific exemptions, Section 101.056, 055, and 060. Separate or together, these make quite clear that the legislature had no intention of subjecting governmental entities to suit for the decisions they make with regard to responding to an emergency and warning of dangerous conditions during those emergencies. Most specifically, I would point the court to Section 101.056, which broadly immunizes governmental entities for the discretionary decisions they make. And I would submit to the court that there is no group of decisions that better embody the type of governmental judgment, deliberation, and decision-making than those in reacting to an emergency.
Do you believe that emergency conditions should be decided as a matter of law if the facts, underlying facts, are undisputed? Or
absolutely.
Do you believe it's a jury question?
It should absolutely be decided as a matter of law if the facts are uncontroverted with regard to that issue, as they are in this case.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Ricky Poole and Ms. Kimberly Keller present argument to the respondents. Ms. Keller will open for the first 5 minutes.
May it please the court, my name is Kim Keller. I'm here along with co-counsel Ricky Poole and Les Mendelson on behalf of the respondents, the Hartmans. If the court will so indulge, I will be addressing in my time before the court our challenge to this court's jurisdiction to consider this appeal, and Mr. Poole will be addressing our responses to the issues presented by the city within the appeal. As the court knows, we are challenging this court's jurisdiction based largely in part on what we contend is an untimely filing of the petition. The crux of our argument is that because the city filed only a request for en banc reconsideration and did not file a motion for rehearing, a traditional motion for panel rehearing, the timeline under Rule 53.7 was not told. We support our argument based on the plain language of Rule 53.7, which states that only a motion for rehearing will toll the deadline for the petition, and if a motion for rehearing is not filed, the deadline ends within 30 days after the opinion is issued.
But a motion for rehearing en banc is presented to the original panel, correct?
That is correct. It's presented to every member of the court. However, the rules do draw a distinction between a motion for rehearing under 49.1 and a motion for en banc reconsideration under 49.7. And this argument is not coming from left field. There are four judges on the Court of Criminal Appeals who, in December of 2003, issued a concurring opinion discussing the distinction and held that and stated that if a motion for en banc reconsideration is the only motion filed, the deadline for the petition is not told. In fact, the court, Judge Johnson is the one who wrote the opinion, stated, "This is a trap for the unwary." The language in the Court of Criminal Appeals petition deadline, the rule, which is 68.2, is exactly the same as the language in this court's petition deadline in 53.7. We also, the court may ask, well, why should we consider what the Court of Criminal Appeals is asking us to consider? And this court historically has relied on the Court of Criminal Appeals. Just this month, in March, I think it's March 10th, in Hyundai Motor Company versus Vasquez, this court cited to and really looked at the analysis of the Court of Criminal Appeals in deciding whether a voir dire question was a commitment question. And within that opinion, this court cited to Davenport versus Garcia, a 1992 opinion out of this court, where this court stated, we give thoughtful consideration to our sister court because we want to make sure that when we're looking at statutory language, we have consistency across the board. I also asked the court to look to Rule 19.1 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure, which was amended in 2003. In 19.1, which affects the Intermediate Court of Appeals plenary power, the court did enter an amendment. There was an amendment to the rule that included language to say, even if an en banc motion is filed, that extends the plenary power. This court did not see fit to amend 53.7 at that time. The last amendment to Rule 53.7 was in 1997. So we've got 19.1, including extra language for an en banc motion. Rule 53.7 does not do the same. And so we ask the court, if it does wish to extend Rule 53.7 to en banc motions, to make that extension through its rulemaking authority, to not simply change the rules mid-appeal, but to do so through its rulemaking authority like it did in 19.1. And if unless the court has any further questions, I will defer to Mr. Poole to address the remainder of our appellate issues.
I'm wondering on en banc, you can file a motion for en banc hearing before you argue to a panel. You can file it any time. You can file it first off. In fact, if the, you know, on a multi-member court, multi-panel court, if you've got one three-judge panel saying something that's flat against you, you might be well advised to ask for the whole thing en banc, since usually panels don't reverse each other. So then the difference between asking for en banc before you get a panel opinion and after, isn't the rehearing en banc after really more of a rehearing than an en banc?
Well, Your Honor, you're right. I mean, you are asking the court to rehear what its decision has been. However, we're stuck with the language of the rule, and the language of the rule is clear. Motion for rehearing versus en banc, and we're just asking the court to apply the rule as written.
So if the briefing said exactly the same in two different motions, and one was titled motion for rehearing and the other was titled motion for en banc reconsideration, you'd say they should be treated differently.
That's correct, and a lot of times, Your Honor, that's what happens. In fact, the fourth court, the court below, requires in its local rules that if you're going to request both en banc and rehearing, you've got to file two separate motions. And we're just asking that the court follow that procedure as long as its own procedures.
Thank you, counsel. May it please the court. My name is Ricky Poole, and I also represent the respondents in this appeal. Let me first address the emergency exception that's been raised by the City of San Antonio. Initially, I think that it's important, as counsel for the city noted, that there are really only two cases that have taken this exception outside of the Chase cases, at least two published cases, those being Whitaker and the Bowie case. Now, in Whitaker, you at least had the use of a vehicle. You had a police officer or a fire department employee who had a vehicle across the roadway. The latter case took the issue a step further. And we believe that, in fact, in that case, in Durham, the court did go too far.
I appreciate distinguishing those cases, but, you know, this court's not bound by the Fort Worth court or the Texarkana court. We're bound by what the legislature tells us, and the fact that the bar or the courts of appeals hadn't come up with an explanation before doesn't mean, well, nobody's ever thought of it before that court was rejected. What is this? I mean, it does say is in compliance with the laws and ordinances if it's an emergency, reacting to an emergency situation, and surely placing barricades around a flood is reacting to an emergency situation, isn't it?
Placing barricades can be reacting to an emergency situation. In this case, though, the city's not arguing that there was a direct connection between failing to place barricades on one side of the roadway and the flood itself. The city's argument is much more global than that. The city's saying we had a huge flood, and therefore anything we do within the confines of that flood is going to be accepted. And I think, Justice Medina, your question about carte blanche is directly on point. The issue has to be, to what degree is this exception going to swallow the rule? And that's what we have in this case if this court applies the city's reasoning. Now, the reason that I've cited to those two cases is not to say that nobody had ever thought of it before, but actually the people were looking at the statute the way that the legislature intended, and that is that it should apply where an employee is doing something in a negligent manner. We all accept the fact that the employee is acting negligently. When you run through a red light, that's negligence. But there's an exception for running through that red light because there's a public policy consideration, and that is that you want the public employee, this first responder, to be able to do his or her job because they're helping the public too. So there's a balancing test going on. You don't have that here. In fact, if the court finds that this exception applies in this case, really what you're saying is the opposite. You're saying that the city doesn't have that duty anymore unless it acts with reckless disregard or conscious indifference.
How do you draw the line? How do you make the distinction?
In every case, there should be a nexus between whatever the emergent situation is and the conduct at issue. And that's why the Chase cases are so clear. Because in every one of those cases, if it applies, there is an emergency situation. The police officer that's responding to a call, the fire engine that's trying to get to a fire. You have a nexus between the emergency and the conduct that falls below the standard set forth in 101.021. And in fact, even if you look at the language of 101.021, the first part of 101.021 speaks to property damage, injuries, or death caused by an employee. Now, the second portion, which is really the portion that we fall under in this case, talks about a governmental unit and personal or real property where the governmental unit would be liable if it were a private person. So there are really two different avenues of liability against a governmental entity contained in 021. One is where the governmental employee does something which is negligent, such as using a motor vehicle in a manner that violates the laws in the state of Texas. When you go over and look at the language of the emergency exception, that language also speaks to an employee. And I think that language is very telling. It talks about that this chapter does not apply to a claim arising from the action of an employee while responding to an emergency call or reacting to an emergency situation. The city of San Antonio has presented no evidence that Robert Mencias, who was the city employee that arrived on the scene to put out the barricades, failed to put the barricades on the west side of Salado Creek because of some emergency situation. At a bare minimum, the city should be required to show that sort of a nexus.
Well, as I understand, the argument is there was a barricade already there put by TxDOT, and so you just, you know, you've got a certain number of barricades in the world, and when there's a 10-inch rainfall, you got to decide where to spread them out. And what's wrong with that?
Your Honor, if the argument, if Mr. Macias's reasoning was that he had been putting barricades all over the city of San Antonio and he was simply out of barricades, that might have shown an emergency condition that he was reacting to. But those aren't the facts of this case. His testimony was he did see a barricade there. That's his testimony. And it's our position that one barricade on a four-lane highway says nothing about any kind of warning.
Divided highway or?
It's a divided highway. That's right. Two one way, two the other.
I mean, divided like Interstate 35 or divided like four lanes, two in each direction right next to each other out here on 15th Street.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And his testimony was...
Which is correct?
The second. That it's four lanes.
We usually don't call those a divided highway if they're stuck together.
I understand. And I apologize, but what I'm talking about is four lanes with one barricade. One barricade that doesn't even completely cover one of those four lanes. But even if you accept the fact that that was his reasoning, that reasoning had nothing to do with an emergency condition. And so then it becomes a fact question as to whether or not the city of San Antonio breached its duty and failed to warn. Or did that one barricade create a warning?
What would be the situation if the city of any small town in Texas didn't have the resources to put up barricades and was faced with the identical situation? So instead of sending out its one unit police force, they got over the public radios and warned everybody to stay home. Would they have fulfilled their duty?
Well, we believe that would go to the formulation of policy. And the formulation of policy is not going to be subject to the Tort Claims Act. So, yes, if the policy was, whenever it rains, we're just going to go on the loudspeaker and say everybody stay home, that would be the policy. Now, that may be subject to some kind of legal challenge, but it's not going to be actionable under the Tort Claims Act. But here we know what the policy of the city of San Antonio was. We have Robert Mencias, their own employee, who testified that when there's water over the road, our policy is to block the roadway. The only reason he didn't block the other side of the road wasn't because of an emergency, but because he hadn't been instructed to do so. His testimony was that even if that barricade that he said was there wasn't there, he still wouldn't have barricaded that side of the road. Not because he didn't have the barricades, and not because he had to go somewhere else, but simply because he had not been instructed to do so. We believe that raises a fact question on whether or not the city of San Antonio failed to adequately warn. Now, the emergency doctrine, even if this court was somehow to apply that emergency doctrine globally, and we believe if the court does so, it's going to vastly expand that doctrine, and this case really does give the court the opportunity to rein that doctrine in the way that the legislature, we believe, apparently intended it to only apply in these specific, narrow situations. But if the court does find that the emergency doctrine should be applied in a global manner, you still have the language regarding conscious indifference and reckless disregard. And we believe on a plea to the jurisdiction that we should at least be allowed to amend our pleading and to have that as a jury question in this case. Is it conscious disregard, even if this somehow constitutes an emergency situation, for the city to barricade one side and apparently protect travelers that are moving in a westerly direction, but not to protect travelers on the same roadway that are traveling in an easterly direction? So in any event, we believe that this plea to the jurisdiction, the Fourth Court of Appeals was correct, and this matter should be returned back to the trial court. Now let me very quickly address the Attorney General's argument regarding the barricade, and the barricade constitutes a warning. First of all, whether or not the barricade constitutes a warning, the question has to be a warning of what? Is it a warning that you shouldn't go through the street? Is it a warning that the road has been closed? Is it a warning that there's going to be water on the other side of this bridge? The Attorney General seems to believe that anytime it rains really hard, what that means to everyone that's traveling on the roadway is you're on your own. And that can't be the law in the state of Texas. The law in the state of Texas has always been that there has to be some knowledge of the defective condition itself. When this court decided the Kitchen case, the court looked at the fact that there was precipitation and there were freezing temperatures. And so people on the roadway would know that there would be ice on things such as bridges that are spanning an area of the roadway. But in this case, this isn't a low water crossing. In fact, this is a bridge. You would expect the water to be under the bridge, not over the bridge and over part of the roadway on the other side. You also have the darkness. There's testimony in this case from the eyewitnesses at the scene that you could see virtually nothing. The way that the road dipped is significant in this case. And the fact that in the pleadings, the plaintiff, Ms. Obar, had no knowledge of this area. She was going a different route in an effort to avoid the water. She was trying to act as an ordinary, prudent driver would. But in this case, she came up on something that she did not and could not have expected. This isn't a case where, because there's water on the road, the car hydroplanes. This is a case where she encountered what was called a roaring river on this highway.
Well, in that instance, the Attorney General, as I understand it, argues someone makes that decision to enter high water, then they do so at their own peril. How would you respond to that?
Well, Your Honor,
is that an issue for a jury to decide? Or
we think it definitely is a jury question at that point. I mean, what this case would come down to, first of all, is this a premise defect or a special defect? We believe that this constitutes an obstacle on the roadway, the water itself. And the reason for that is if you have a river going across the road, that's an obstacle. But the question that this court raised, the second part of that analysis, has to be, is it something that is unusual? And it clearly would be unusual to have this Salado Creek, which normally is nearly, in this area, it's relatively a dry creek, and going over the bridge, to all of a sudden have this roaring river, as it was described by the witnesses.
Mr. Poole, if it's, as they suggest, a mixed question so that we have to have facts determined and then the question of emergency being law, if we assume that we might want to consider that, what facts are there in this case that are controverted that we would need a jury to decide?
On which issue?
On what your client knew or she appreciated, those underlying facts as to whether or not there was an emergency that she was aware of, a situation she was aware of.
Well, for example, to the extent the court is going to impute any type of knowledge upon Ms. Obar, we believe that is certainly a fact question in this case.
But is there any controversy about what happens? I understand your pleading is she changed directions and went over there. Are there any witnesses that can go any further than that?
We have witnesses at the scene that testify that this vehicle did not dip as you would customarily expect it to if she had seen the water first, that she hit the water head on. And also, she hit the water at a high rate of speed, not over the speed limit, but at a high rate of speed, indicating that she did not expect that she was coming up to water. This wasn't a case, such as in a low water crossing case, where someone comes up to the water, sits there, thinks about it for a little while, and then proceeds into the water.
Thanks, Counselor. Are there any further questions?
Thank you.
Your Honor, responding, I guess, for the state's position, but really also our position, sort of Mr. Poole's last comments. This really is sort of, in one regard, this is sort of like the Kitchen case based on the facts that they themselves have pled. Ms. Obar was well aware of the emergency. It's certainly a real-world emergency, whether it winds up being a statutory connected emergencies question. But in this real-world emergency, she was well aware of it. She was rerouting, having come back from this wedding, trying to find her way home as best she could in a situation where all the evidence would seem to indicate from their own pleadings, she was well aware of the situation. The evidence appears to be undisputed that there was a barricade. Now, probably what they really want are more than just a warning. They probably want barricades all the way across the roadway, and they really want it to be made safe. But they're only entitled to one or the other, and the city, we believe, exercise its duty by at least seeing if there was a barricade there.
But did you conclusively establish no control or the absence of control?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. In looking at that earlier, I think that there was, I think the Fourth Court of Appeals thought that there was a fact question on control, looking at the contract in emergency situations. I know with the city, we tried to allege on control of that highway. But had there not been a barricade there, had the dispatcher told that person to put a barricade there in the absence of one, I'm assuming my guy would put a barricade there.
Can you respond to Ms. Keller's argument regarding the jurisdiction issue?
Well, Your Honor, I want to perhaps reference Justice Wainwright's comments from the earlier argument about when we talked about the trap for the unwary, we do try to decide these cases on the merits, not some sort of procedural trap, if you will. I certainly believe that a motion for rehearing, a motion for reconsideration, whatever is attached to that, is a proper invocation. So, I mean, obviously, we believe that the document as filed was appropriate. Just briefly on the emergency, page 136 of the supplemental record describes an event that was widespread, that the storm taxed all resources, 5,184 calls to the police department, 192 water rescues, 461 people's lives were saved, 11 deaths. Very serious emergency, very serious situation. We believe there is obviously a nexus, even internally, between this event in the sense that our barricader was out there responding to dispatch and doing that job at that location and at many locations throughout the city on the 40th.
Does the magnitude of the emergency determine the responsibility of the city responding to the emergency?
I think the magnitude of the emergency may, at least in my judgment, be ultimately the law question that a court would determine, is this an emergency for purposes of 0552? And then liability flows from that based upon whether it's gross negligence or negligence. I think this case, like Durham County, where they said it easily falls within, referencing the entire situation, I think this is an easy call. There may be harder calls, no question about that. There may even be ones where facts have to determine where we ultimately come down in the category. But this is not one of those.
Mr. Postle, let me ask a question.
Yes, sir.
Assume for a moment that there may be a jurisdictional problem. Do we just redo this?
I hope not.
I mean, if you go back, you can file another plea to the jurisdiction. Right. The Court of Appeals is going to hold law of the case as far as they're concerned, and then you come up here?
Well, actually, if we had to go through that process, I have hopes that the Fourth Court, we now have El Paso. I think, really, since the Whitaker case, I think probably the Fourth Court's the only court that hasn't gone down that route. I mean, we may be up here again, but in a different posture if the court hasn't.
But in any event, you just go back to trial court, file a plea to the jurisdiction, and here we go again?
Here we go again, yes.
All right, there's nothing to stop that.
Not if there's this jurisdictional problem.
All
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.